Good evening. Yeah, there we go. All right. Thank you. All right. Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can, of course, find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the YouTube channel. I am Mike Masnick, the founder and CEO of Floor 64 and the editor of the Tech Dirt blog, and I'm also the moderator for today's program. As you hopefully know already, our guest today is Barry Eisler, who is sitting right here, and a former tech attorney and startup executive in Silicon Valley and Japan. And also, as his bio always makes sure we know, spent 3 years in a covert position with the CIA's Directorate of Operations. And you know, now that I have him on stage, we can find out what he was really doing in all that covertness. And of course, that experience, I'm sure, helped prompt him to author 11 best-selling novels, including his latest, which we're here to talk about in part, The God's Eye View. Barry was kind enough to send me an advance copy of the book, and I can say that it is an absolute page-turner in that I literally could not put it down. I did not sleep for a few days because it's really good. It's also incredibly full of real world details and references to things that are actually happening in the news. And as I've said, if you want to learn about why we should fear the NSA while still being tremendously entertained, then The God's Eye View is a book for you. It is a story, of course, about mass surveillance, about the NSA, about whistleblowers, intrepid reporters, and of course, the usual edge of your seat action, which is why you keep turning those pages over and over again, whether digitally or on paper. We only have about an hour here, and Barry and I have known each other for a long time, and we have a way of having our conversations go on for much longer than that, covering many different topics, so we'll try and cram as much as we can into this hour that we have. So welcome, Barry Eisler, back to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. Thank you. Thank you for coming out tonight. So nice to see everyone here. Thank you.
All right. So let's start in. Again, as I said, there's lots of different topics that we can talk about, but let's start with the book, with okay. The God's Eye View. As mentioned, it's very focused on sort of surveillance stuff and NSA stuff. So the easy question is kind of, what inspired you to write this book right now?
Yeah. So I get all my best thriller plot ideas from the U.S. government. Right, because the government's doing all these horrific things, and that I find is really disturbing as a citizen, but as a thriller novelist, it's like Christmas. So I had this idea a couple years ago, a little more than a couple years ago at this point, actually, closer to 3 years ago. I was working on my previous book, and I got this notion for a far-ranging system of surveillance and how it might work, not so much at the technical level, I'm not very technical myself, but more at the operational level, like how the government might use it. And I liked the idea, and I started thinking about it, and I thought, what if there were a system like this and somebody came across it? Because that's just thriller stuff, right? What if somebody came across it and recognized that there was something really bad about all this? What would that person do? And I thought, well, a person's got to be restrained or constrained, rather, in some way. Well, what if it were an analyst, like a woman maybe who's got a small son with a disability and she really needs that paycheck? Maybe there's some other constraints, like maybe she's a single mother and her ex-husband's a deadbeat and she's got an ailing father with Alzheimer's who's in an expensive nursing home and she really doesn't have a lot to fall back on. She needs that money. But she finds out about this program and is disturbed by it because she knows this thing is, it can't be legal, it can't be constitutional, and she feels like she has to do something. And that's just conflict already. Internal conflict as a novelist I really like. So that's how the story started to get built out. My concern was that what I had in mind for this system of extremely pervasive surveillance was not realistic. I thought, can I really make this work on the page? And my brand has a lot to do with realism. I really try to get things as right and as real as I possibly can in everything I write. So that was my biggest doubt. That was where I had some qualms. I was like, I don't know. I mean, does the government really have something like this? Well, I was in Tokyo in June 2013 doing research for the previous book when I opened up Glenn Greenwald's page on The Guardian, because that's what I typically do, or at the time I did in the morning, now it's The Intercept, and read that just hair-raising first report based on a guy that just a few days later we learned was Edward Snowden. And it just blew my week of researching in Tokyo, because I was obsessed with following the news. And what I realized is that I had actually not been ambitious enough in my plotting for what was going to be the basis for this program and the book called God's Eye. And so I have followed the Snowden revelations, the reporting, based on Edward Snowden's revelations pretty carefully, and have gotten tons of ideas from everything I've read. So much so that there's an 18-page bibliography at the end of the novel, because it's really important for me that people understand, hopefully after you've been super entertained, as Mike has assured you will be, I want people to come to that bibliography and start paging through it and saying, oh my God, this stuff is real? Because it is. Almost everything I've written about the book is real. There's a little speculation, but all the technologies exist, and probably some ones that I didn't even dream up. Everything in here exists, and as Americans, I think we should find this sort of government capability extremely disquieting.
So, in talking about Edward Snowden, there's always sort of this big debate about, whistleblower or traitor, I guess, if you want to go to extremes. Yeah. And you've been somewhat vocal in sort of talking about your opinion on that, and I know that a lot of other alumni of the intelligence service may come out in a different position than you do. So, where do you come down on that question, and kind of what are your thoughts on Edward Snowden himself?
Right. So, for me, unequivocally, Edward Snowden is a hero and a whistleblower in the dictionary sense of the word. There are two things that I think are really important to understand about what he's done, and that are frequently distorted in establishment media renditions of his actions. So the first thing to understand is that there's no such thing as an oath of secrecy. And you may have come across this phrase many times. I know I have. Some of the cream of America's establishment pundocracy would have you believe that government employees take an oath of secrecy. I remember David Brooks in the New York Times talking about how Edward Snowden violated his oath of secrecy, and Josh Marshall in Talking Points Memo, and many others. It became a meme. It's around today. It's just one of these zombie memes that's probably never going to go away, even no matter how much it's contradicted by the fact. So I can tell you, as someone who did, in fact, spend 3 years in a covert position in the CIA, there's no oath of secrecy. There is no oath of secrecy. You know what there is for secrecy in the CIA and the NSA and all the government, all wings of the government? A non-disclosure agreement. It's an NDA. I don't mean to belittle NDAs. I was a technology lawyer here in the Valley, for Silicon Valley, for about a decade, and I know a fair amount about trade secrets, and I believe that it's important to protect your trade secrets with NDAs, and it's good to have a good NDA, and I think that if you sign one, it's enforceable, and it's not unimportant, it's not trivial, but it's not an oath. You don't swear an oath. Like, if you go visit Facebook, they'll make you sign an NDA. And as crazy and extreme as Facebook is as a company, they're not yet having anybody sign an oath. So there is no oath of secrecy. It's just an NDA. So there's the propaganda, right? I mean, it doesn't sound like that's, somebody violates an NDA. That probably happens all the time. It's not such a big deal. We got to gin it up into some kind of oath, which it isn't. But there is an oath. There is an oath that every intelligence employee takes. It's basically an oath of office. You know what the oath is? You know what it is. It's an oath to protect and defend the Constitution. Now, I took that oath, and so did Edward Snowden. And I still take that oath very seriously. So what's critical to understand, and what gets distorted in almost every establishment rendition of what's going on here, is they talk about an oath of secrecy that doesn't exist, and they ignore an oath to protect and defend the Constitution that does exist. that I have an honest conversation, a reasonable conversation, like a reality-based conversation about what Snowden did, regardless of whether you think his actions were warranted or not, you have to account for the fact that he had two competing imperatives. One is his NDA, and the other is his oath to protect and defend the Constitution. And this is, you may think he made the wrong decision, and I wouldn't agree with you, but I would respect that point of view. You would say, no, actually, his oath to protect the Constitution wasn't in play. And these programs, even though at least two federal courts have subsequently found these programs to be, in fact, unconstitutional, forget about that for the moment. You could say his oath to protect the Constitution did not come into play, or he should have done it some other way, or whatever. But you have to acknowledge that he did swear an oath to protect the Constitution, and I believe that he legitimately, honestly believed his oath was in play. And yes, it contradicted with his NDA, and he was in a position where, like a novel and a character in a good novel, he had to decide which one of these things was more important because he couldn't have it both ways. So that's one thing that's really important to understand. You just never hear, oh, it's all about the oath of secrecy that doesn't even exist. That's one thing. And there's one other thing that I think is important to understand. It makes me a little crazy. I have had this conversation with journalists or people who call themselves journalists. And it's amazing how much they want to focus on the fact that, well, he broke the law. I mean, that's another meme, right? That's another talking point. You hear that all the time. He broke the law. He broke the law. And that's, they think like that's where the conversation should end. And what's curious about that to me is, yeah, he did. He broke the law. He signed an NDA, said he'd keep this stuff secret, and then he gave it to some journalists. So you got me. You know, Edward Snowden broke the law, like golf clap. You know? But he revealed criminality, vast criminality, on the part of our government. And if I have to focus my journalistic attentions on the criminal wrongdoing of an individual on the one hand versus criminal wrongdoing by the entire government on the other, well, which one is likely to cause more damage? A lone individual citizen breaking the law or the government breaking the law? So I feel like, look, if you want to acknowledge that Edward Snowden broke the law, it's fine, he did. But you can't, in my opinion, legitimately stop the inquiry at that point when the government criminality that Snowden revealed is so much more damaging. Now, the response to that is often, oh, come on, what if everybody did what Snowden did? I love this man. I was like, what a wonderful world that would be. But forget about that for a moment. It always interests me when people want to introduce fantasy scenarios as a way of avoiding talking about reality. Because here's the reality. Whistleblowing is incredibly rare. Why is it rare? We know why it's rare. A lot of reasons, and one of them is the risks and punishments that whistleblowers face are huge. They're draconian. You see what happened to Thomas Drake, Bill Binney, Colleen Rowley, Jocelyn Radak. Chelsea Manning was tortured, according to the UN Special Rapporteur Against Torture. So becoming a whistleblower is a huge act of courage and conscience and conviction. Not many people, empirically, are willing to take the risks. We know that, right? So having a fantasy conversation about what would happen if everybody did something that demonstrably only a few people are willing to do is just a dodge. In fact, whistleblowing is really rare. Government criminality exists. So to avoid discussing government criminality for purposes of having a fantasy conversation about what the world would be like if everyone were free to disregard an NDA is, again, a very strange thing to me. And if it's not deliberate propaganda, then it's probably being driven by thoughtlessness. And I think, you know, propaganda or thoughtlessness is not a bad rubric for understanding most of what passes for establishment journalism in America today. Am I being too much of a downer? Because I'm actually kind of a funny guy sometimes.
Yeah, no, I think it's good. We actually have gotten a couple of follow-up questions already just about that sort of difference between the NDA and an oath, and sort of summarizing a couple of these questions, does that difference matter if what he's revealing then jeopardizes, say, you know, people or operations, right, or things that are happening? How, right, do you feel about that?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I mean, this concept is often called harm minimization in journalistic circles, and I don't know any journalist, not even WikiLeaks, which often gets incorrectly tarred with this notion that they just dump all the information, they don't do any harm. minimization. That's not true either. WikiLeaks is a little further ahead maybe of some journalistic outlets in what they'll publish, but even they go through a harm minimization process. And in fact, the reason that Snowden went to the press rather than just uploading everything that he took directly to the internet, which I think we can agree he was more than capable of doing on a technical level, was precisely because he wanted harm minimization procedures in place and went to two journalists in particular, three, who he really trusted, Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, and Bart Gellman. He wanted them to make the call on what does the public need to know about versus how do we weigh things in another direction where the benefit of the public's right to know would be outweighed by some actual harm that might be done. So I know that was just from seeing documentaries like Laura Poitras's Oscar-winning documentary, Citizen Four, which if you haven't seen it, it is gripping. Like sometimes you think, ah, documentary, you know, it's going to be a little dry. Like I should watch it, but The Avengers is on tonight. So probably I won't. It's amazing. You feel like you are in the room watching history being made. It's an extraordinary movie. Really deserved that Oscar. Anyway, so they talked during the movie, they talked about, Snowden talked about his own goals in terms of harm minimization, but the results also speak for what he did. There is not any evidence at all that a single person anywhere in the world has been harmed because of what Snowden revealed to the press. And if you read the government's accusations and the government's things like, you know, henchmen and lackeys and words like that. They're enablers, they're allies in the establishment media. You wouldn't know that, right? Because these phrases come out, they're like grave harm to national security, jeopardizing national security, blood on his hands, right? You know what? I read some of those phrases and I was like, where have I heard those before? Why do they sound so familiar? Right, I saw that other excellent documentary, Daniel Ellsberg, The Most Dangerous Man in America. And those are exactly the same phrases, verbatim, that the government was using against Ellsberg, who's now treated almost universally as a hero for revealing the Pentagon Papers, which proved to the American people that the American government was lying to us about the course and prospects of the Vietnam War. Ellsberg's biggest regret, by the way, with regard to the Pentagon Papers, is that he didn't act sooner. He might have saved more lives. Everyone agrees that Ellsberg is a hero now, and that's inconvenient if you want to make Snowden out to be some kind of blood on his hands, agent of China, agent of Russia, et cetera, traitor, because it's very hard to distinguish between what the one person did and what the other did. So, anyway.
Yeah, so, I mean, after Ellsberg, you know, revealed his thing, there was all of that. But then, you know, some things did happen out of that and change did occur. What is your opinion of kind of where things, you know, what's changed, if anything, and how far has it gone? How much further do you think it needs to go sort of in response to the post-Snowden document?
Right. So that's another interesting bit of propaganda I come across sometimes. Like people always say like, well, has anything really changed? And I mean, short of something really cataclysmic, you can probably always make the argument that, well, nothing's really changed, right? I guess. I mean, the NSA is still fighting to maintain all the programs it can. What do you expect our intelligence establishment to do? They call themselves the intelligence community. I don't really like to be so friendly to them. I think that's just a little too self-congratulatory. It's like, sounds so warm and fuzzy. But the truth is, Snowden's revelations have had a huge impact in a lot of areas. So depending on how you want to define it, I'd be curious about your thoughts about this, Mike, but I think probably the biggest impact of all is how much the revelations have driven the development of ubiquitous, easy-to-use encryption and the public's understanding of just how critical encryption is for protecting our privacy. And there's been a lot of, there has been a real impact in that regard. People, there have been Pew Research polls indicating that the number of people now who are encrypting their websites with HTTPS or who are using the Tor browser, at least know what it is, or taking other online measures to protect their privacy, has the numbers of people who've done this have increased dramatically. And this matters a lot because I don't want to give away too much in God's eye, but I'll just say this much. If there are only a few people in the world who are using, say, the Tor browser or other means of anonymization and encryption, then the government can fairly easy focus a lot of retail-level resources on whoever they're able to determine is using that encryption. Look at it this way. Like in a room like this or in any room where everybody's talking, if only a few people are whispering, it's probably not that hard to try to key on the people who are whispering because you figure, hey, those are the ones who have something to hide. That's interesting. I want to key on that. And so what ubiquitous encryption would change that dynamic. It would mean that the government wouldn't know who should I be listening to, who are the people who really have something, who are the journalists, who are the anti-war activists, who are the dissidents. Those are the people who would be using encryption, and you want those people to be, their behavior, to be concealed in a sea of encryption. Snowden has had a tremendous impact in that regard, and I would argue that in some ways that impact, I could be wrong, I'm sure reasonable people could differ, but I think in some ways that impact might be his most significant yet. Beyond that, he did prove that the director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, was lying, which is a felony, lying to the Senate during testimony. He was lying when he told Senator Wyden that the NSA didn't collect information, wasn't surveilling millions or tens of millions of Americans, at least not wittingly. That's just as much of a lie as there could be. Naturally, he's still in office. What can you do? But at least it's important because it changes the dialogue. You start to understand how much the government lies to us and with how much impunity. Also, these programs, as I mentioned a little earlier, have now been declared illegal and unconstitutional with words like Orwellian being thrown into the mix. And I think that's important for people to understand too. Most important, last, I would say, is what Snowden said he hoped to provoke at the outset. His biggest thing was, he said, of course I have my opinions, but I'm not taking a position on whether we should have these programs or not. If the American people decide knowingly that they think these sorts of programs are a good idea, then as a democracy we can vote for them and have them. But what we can't have, consistent with being a democracy, is that these programs, these vast programs, wherein the government knows more and more about the people and the people know less and less about the government, we cannot have these programs rolled out in secret with no accountability. We don't even know about them. That doesn't work. So I think he has had a huge impact, yeah.
All right, so I need to ask you, you've been going on for about 20 minutes along this line, which is great and very, very interesting, but it brings up a really big question, which I know you've been asked before, but I'm sure the people here would like to know, which is, why did you join the CIA in the first place if this is the way you feel about things?
Yeah, that's a fair question. Well, so it was quite a few years ago, and I've always been a pretty patriotic guy. I am, and I always have been. And my patriotism when I was in my 20s expressed itself in what I would consider to be the typical young man's way, right? I mean, I was kind of poisoned by testosterone and had a pretty primitive understanding of America and the rest of the world. I'd never lived abroad. I had a lot of information. I read voraciously, thinking I was getting variety, but actually the things I was reading were like the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, the New Republic, Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy. I mean, you don't really need to read all those things. They all have essentially the same establishment viewpoint of America and its place in the world. In general, we can always find exceptions. So I had a lot of information, but not a lot of thoughtfulness, not a lot of wisdom. And I was interested in the world, and I thought it would be kind of cool to work for the CIA and defend democracy thereby, and that's why I joined. It was only 3 years because it's a really big bureaucracy, and what I've learned about myself in the ensuing, I don't know, quarter century or so, is I'm kind of entrepreneurial and I like to be in charge. I mean, I went from the government to a 600 attorney law firm to a 4-person startup to just myself writing books. And then even that became onerous because I had to work with a publisher, and I found that sort of oppressive. So the first chance I got, I started self-publishing my book. So now I could like, and at some point I looked back and said, do you think this is all a coincidence, Bear? So it was a frustrating place for, and I think it would be a frustrating place for anyone who likes to be in charge, trusts his or her own instincts, and has a kind of entrepreneurial bent to work. It was a great experience. It was a fascinating experience. I'm glad I had it. It's just that now I realize that what America really needs to be as strong as possible in the world, although that's only one value. I think it gets overstated. I mean, strength is one value of many. To be a good citizen of the world, to be decent and good. In fact, one thing that disturbs me a little bit about America is this obsession with being great. I mean, I think it's super neurotic. If you knew someone like that, if you knew a person who was always going on about how they needed to be great, probably wouldn't want to spend a lot of time with that person. I'd like us to spend a little more time as a country being concerned about being good rather than being great. And for those purposes, in addition to things like national strength, we don't really need more military power, more spies, that kind of stuff. I think what we need is a little more self-examination, a little more accountability. I mean, after all, with great power, we know, should come great accountability. Those two things have to go together, or there's going to be, something's going to get out of balance and out of control. So my patriotism tends to express itself now in more as a kind of watchdog critic, you know, loving critic, patriotic critic, kind of way. I think the country would benefit a lot more from that than from a few more rah-rah establishment pundits who don't really think about what they're saying and just reflexively take the party line.
Well, so this is a question from the audience, but is a good follow-up to a point that you brought up earlier concerning how more people are using encryption. There's a lot more encryption out there. There's also been a lot more concern lately coming from certain circles about encryption, and people are talking about things like ISIS using encryption or, you know, the Paris bombers or, you know, attackers, potentially, using encryption, though it turns out they didn't actually.
Right.
You know, what do you think of that kind of debate now, this whole going dark debate, as they call it?
I love the you know, when the government's good, it's pretty good. I mean, on the marketing angle. And going dark is awesome. I mean, I can go on about this because I love this stuff. But like when Sarah Palin, I'm not a fan, but when she started talking about death panels 8 years ago, I was like, that's good. That's really good. You get a really clear, vivid image from that, don't you? You know, a bunch of old people looking down at you from the dais and like, no. You know, that's good. It's really good. What did the Democrats offer up against that? Single payer. What do you see when you see single payer? I don't see anything. Maybe I see me. I'm like, I don't want to be the single payer. You know, it's terrible. So those sorts of vivid images can be really good. Most people won't really get too far past them. So going dark, I mean, it sounds scary. Like the FBI, they can't see anymore. Really, like you start seeing the FBI's like got the dark glasses like Stevie Wonder or something. You know, that'd be bad. And people don't really think about what does that really mean. Okay, so a few things about this. First of all, yeah, there's a lot of evidence that ISIS and other terrorist groups use encryption. And the thing about that is it's not new. I mean, the first reports of ISIS or Al-Qaeda, it was Al-Qaeda at the time, using encryption, I think started emerging, I want to say 13 years ago. It might have been 15 years ago. You can Google it. There was a Guardian article. I mean, the notion that committed adversaries of the United States are so stone stupid that they don't know the first thing about encryption is probably right up there as a propaganda tool with the notion that if you read hardened terrorists their rights, they'll clam up. But right before that, they were going to tell you everything. I mean, the guy's like, don't do the Miranda thing because I want to tell you all our operational plan. Oh, you said it. You spoiled it. It's crazy. And by the way, you know, this is the same government who comes up, want to hear another great imagery. I forget what general said this, but he's like, we got to really be careful transporting these prisoners. These are fanatics. These are the kinds of people who'd wriggle free from their bonds and chew through the hydraulic cables of an airplane to bring it down. Yeah, that's a quote. And I said, damn, that is really good. I mean, you see some guy and it's like, it's like, I mean, he's so committed, you know? It's great imagery, genius. But I'm like, wait a minute, you mean the guy, like, he's chewing through the operational cables, but then you say, but he was going to tell you all the plans, but then you gave him the Miranda warnings and he realized he didn't have to talk. I mean, it's like, it's just crazy. They got to get their story straight. So, there's lots of evidence that that terrorist groups have been using encryption forever. There's also evidence that they don't. So, for example, the Paris bombers were brothers. They were living in the same apartment flat. Almost certainly their planning took place in, like, their den or living room. And if the NSA really wants to stop this kind of attack, then it should start getting serious about deploying the kinds of telemonitors that George Orwell depicted in 1984, because we've got to be able to monitor face-to-face conversations in people's bedrooms, living rooms, everywhere. If you want to stop that Paris attack, preventing encryption, backdoors, whatever, is demonstrably, empirically not going to work because these people didn't use encryption to plan the attack. What they did is they met face-to-face. So if we're going to bug every face-to-face conversation in the world, I personally don't think that's a good idea, but you know, line with what Snowden was trying to do, okay, like at least let's have a discussion about that as a society and decide whether we think it's a good idea.
Yeah, and actually just this week there was a paper that came out from Harvard, I don't know if you saw this, that looked at the going dark situation and basically said, like, okay, you may have this tiny part that's going dark, but at the same time, because of all this technology and the smartphones in our pockets and all the internet services that we've used, we've actually given the intelligence services much more access to information. If you look at you know, the pie of information that, yeah. that they do have access to, it's grown. So the idea yeah. that going dark is a big issue,
yeah.
you know, seems a little bit exaggerated.
Yeah, no doubt. And in fact, I think you could even go further and say, to some extent, the fact that we're living in the what the NSA has called in one of its one of the slides Snowden revealed, the golden age of SIGINT, signals intelligence, it's actually a little bit of a disservice to the NSA. Here's what I mean. Do you remember that old, I think it was a Bazooka Joe comic when I was really little, like the guy is looking for something under a streetlight, and someone says, hey, what are you looking for? And he says, oh, I lost my watch over there. And the guy says, why are you looking over here then? And the guy says, because the light's better over here. And I think so much of the NSA's obsession with bulk surveillance is being driven by the fact that it's a technical, it's a cool technical problem that people can solve. People at the NSA can solve. Whether it's actually keeping us safe as it's built is a totally separate question. But as a technical problem, it's really interesting and they can do it. And that makes it attractive, totally separate from its utility as a way of protecting America from attack. So if encryption really did become ubiquitous, the NSA, the FBI, and other intelligence and security organizations would have to go back to the kind of good old-fashioned retail police and intelligence work that so far is the only demonstrated way that that the American government has ever prevented a terrorist attack. There's no evidence at all that bulk surveillance has kept anyone safe from a terror attack. There's none. And in fact, the notion that it has is a myth on the same level as the notion that torture kept us safe or that torture led American forces to find Osama bin Laden, who was at that point basically useless anyway to anyone who wanted to harm America. So these are myths that get promulgated because the government does something and it's not really good, right? Like torture, that's not good. Bulk surveillance, that's not good. And then what are you left with when it comes out that you've been doing these things? What's your only argument? It worked. That's what they want to talk about. That's how the debate is then framed. And if it doesn't even work, what are they left with? It's just illegal. That's not very good.
Yeah, and it's funny. I mean, the Section 215 program in particular, right, you know, that was the first one that Snowden revealed, and there was all this talk about how important it was. And then, you know, Congress, you know, some people started to ask questions and drill down, and finally said that it had stopped like 42 cases of terrorism. And they started to push back, and they're like, exactly. Well, okay, not really. It stopped 13. Right. And then they asked again, and basically they said, okay, yeah. It was one. And then they said, well, what was that one? And it was like a cab driver in San Diego who had sent a couple thousand dollars to, you know, somewhere in the Middle East.
Hamas
and that was the terrorism. Yeah. Yeah. He said, okay, so we have all this program where we're spying on, you know, basically everyone in America, and you caught one guy sending $1,000 to the Middle East.
Exactly.
Seems like maybe disproportionate.
Yeah.
For folks who are listening to this on the radio or at home in a podcast or driving or whatever it might be, as a reminder, this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking to Barry Eisler, former covert CIA operative. Attorney and Silicon Valley startup executive. It is imperative that these things be mentioned whenever you say his name. I do it just when we have lunch. I make sure to repeat that as well. But most importantly, he is the author of many best-selling thriller novels, including the latest, The God's Eye View. And I am Mike Masnick, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, which you may be doing right now. Catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter and see programs videos on our YouTube channel. Quick question. Do you know if Ed Snowden has read the book?
I don't know. I really tried to get it to him, and I was hoping for a blurb, selfishly, I admit. He does have more important things to do than blurb my book. I will acknowledge that.
Well, what are you talking about? He's hanging out. He's got nothing to do.
Right? But no, so far nothing's really come. But, you know, it's not too late for a tweet, so... Ed Snowden, if you're listening to us tonight, and who knows, you may be, go ahead and tweet it out, man.
We can hope. So here's a good question that sort of came up. I mean, you talked a little bit earlier about you know, sort of how things have reacted. And you mentioned a couple of the cases that have sort of gone against the NSA, but it's yeah. been somewhat limited. There have been a couple of cases that have gone their way. You were a lawyer, so you have sort of legal experience. And so someone was asking, you know, do you think that the judiciary system actually, you know, will be able to do anything, or, you know, will they have a role in sort of deciding the fate of American surveillance?
It's a good question, vital question. It does seem to me that that the judiciary has been co-opted by executive fear-mongering on things like, for example, the state secrets privilege. If you know anything about this, it's where it's just metastasized. It used to be that somebody would sue the government for some illegal action, and the government would say, hey, we can't talk about that in open court. It would reveal secrets. And then the court would say, okay, the judge would say, come back in my chamber. We'll discuss that aspect of the case in private, and I'll make some sort of ruling on whether we need to keep that secret or whether we don't. But that doctrine has now been expanded to mean that the government just goes into court and says the case involves secrets, you have to throw it out, the whole thing. So what happens is that citizens can't get their day in court, no matter how much the government has been violating their rights, because the government just claims that some secrets are involved, which if you think about it just on a policy level is crazy. I mean, it certainly would seem to incentivize the government to just say, oh, there are secrets. There are secrets. It's Miller time. Secrets. You know, it's like that scene like in Austin Powers with Dr. Dr. He was like, zip it, zip it, Scotty. And you're like, wait, it's about zip it. So people don't get to litigate these things because of that doctrine. That is definitely a concern. I think it's just an attitude. And it's surprising because I think the founders had anticipated that human nature would make the three branches of government really, four if you include the press, would make the branches of government really jealous of their prerogatives and fight to protect them. And wow, I mean, I don't know. I would have thought so too. I guess I was wrong about human nature because the judiciary is just rolled over on its back and given it up to the executive on so much of this stuff. Congress too, actually, when you consider things like its power to declare war and enforce the War Powers Resolution and things like that. There is another thing that's called a court, but it isn't. And this is also, again, you know, respect to the people who decided to call the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Administrative Body a court. That was genius because everybody thinks it's a court now. And when Obama makes a speech, he can say, look, I want you to know these programs have been blessed by all three branches of government, the executive, the legislative, and the courts too. And it's like, well, wait a minute, man. You call that thing a court, but there's nothing court-like about it. I mean, it does have some retired judges on it, but other than that, if you think about it, it's this is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Its proceedings are conducted in secret. There's no judicial review. There is no adversarial party in the courtroom representing the other side of the case. I mean, it's just not a court. You can call this a lot of things. To me, it's more like the Office of Professional Responsibility or something in the Justice Department. It's an executive advisory body. But calling it a court was genius. And it's there really to rubber, its purpose is to rubber stamp what our intelligence bureaucracy wants to do. And that is, in fact, its effect. I forget the numbers, but it's something like out of 30,000 government requests to conduct bulk surveillance, maybe 11 have been rejected. Or so. It's like a 0.003% rejection level. And even those have then, they've come back and they've, I don't know, dotted the I's, crossed the T's, and those things got through. So yeah, there's not a lot of judicial pushback on any of this that I'm aware of.
All right, I'm going to shift gears a little bit. I know a lot of people here are obviously big fans of yours and your previous books, and I have a whole stack of questions here asking about when the next John Rain book will be coming out.
So. Sorry about that. I got a little political there, didn't I? I did a signing at Kepler's bookstore in Menlo Park last night, and I was trying so hard not to be political, just talk about the book, and here I seem to have gone in the other direction, so apologies.
Sorry, I think that's my fault.
No. I mean, I as you can tell, I'm kind of into the political stuff too. So whoever asked the question, thank you. John Rain is my half Japanese, half American assassin whose specialty is making it look like natural causes. There have been 8 Rain books, including my previous book, Graveyard of Memories, which was a prequel. I really love that book. I mean, I do love all my books, but I really love Graveyard of Memories. You will definitely see more Rain. And in fact, there's a book I'm almost done with that I'm working on right now. It's due at the end of March. It's awesome. I love this book so much, and I could talk about it, but what's the point, because it's not even out yet. But as soon as I'm done with this one, which is another standalone, The next book is another Rain prequel that takes place about 10 years after the events of Graveyard of Memories.
And so a related question on that, because, again, there are a lot of John Rain fans here, which is not surprising and certainly a good thing.
It's nice to hear.
They're just asking, so what drove you to create that character in the first place?
I was living in Tokyo in 1993, and it was an electrifying experience for me. I was training in judo at a place called the Kodokan, which is the birthplace of modern judo. It's judo mecca. I mean, if you're into judo, even if you don't make it to the Kodokan, you want to make it to the Kodokan. Everybody wants to at least have trained at the Kodokan. Yeah, you're nodding, you know. Okay, so what a place. So I was just, it was like a dream come true to train there. And I was really into Tokyo. It's still my favorite city on earth. Respect to San Francisco. This is my second favorite city, but honestly, Tokyo, there's just something about it. I love it. I'm glad to live here. But Tokyo was just electrifying to me. I can't say why exactly, but the first time I went there, it was like metropolitan love at first sight. And my wife and I had made all these friends, really interesting people, some expats, some Japanese, and they were taking us to these jazz clubs they called live houses at Aibohasu, training at the Kodokan, as I said, all these great whiskey bars and coffee places. And during all of this, an image that came to me of two men following another man down the street in a part of Tokyo called Shibuya. The street is called Dogenzaka for anyone who knows the city. And I wasn't even there at the time. I was actually on my way to work. I was a lawyer at the time. But it was a really vivid image, these two men following another man down the street. And I started asking myself questions about that image, like, well, who are these guys? Who are these two men who are following the other man? Why are they following him? What did they do? And then I realized, they're assassins. They're going to kill him. Which, if you think about it, is a little bit of a strange, kind of an ink blot test question. But that was my answer. They weren't going to help him. You know, he didn't drop his wallet. And they're like, sir, you lost it. They're going to kill him. But then the answers just led to more questions. Like, okay, but why? What did he do? Who hired them? How did they become assassins? How do you become an assassin? And I started writing it thinking it felt like a story, which it did. And, 8 years later, the story was a novel, and I sold the rights, and that's how it all got rolling.
One more John Rain question. As I said, we got a lot, and I'm not going to read them all. But someone was asking, I know this question has come up a bunch as well in other venues. There was talk, at least, that there was going to be a series, potentially with Keanu Reeves. Yeah. So someone was asking kind of what is the status of that, if anything.
Right. So the Keanu Reeves television series. Well, it's hard to say. I've been through the whole somebody buys your rights and tries to set something up, movie, television, whatever, a few times now, more than a few. And it can be really exciting, but I think the best advice I can give for any writer who winds up in this position is try not to get too excited until you've actually made the popcorn, you're sitting down with the remote control, and it's, you know, it's 9 o'clock Sunday night or whatever. But will it happen? I don't know. It's been a lot of fun. This one's been the most fun and exciting for me of all of them because, yeah, Keanu is attached. I've gotten to meet him a few times. Want to hear a couple Keanu stories? I don't know if we got any fans in the audience. Okay. I think he's awesome. So, and I've always wanted Keanu to play John Rain. People always ask at book signing. So from the early days, like 14, I did my the launch signing was at Kepler's last night, and I realized, wow, this is my 11th launch signing at Kepler's. And the first one was in 2002. It's been 14 years. It's crazy. Last night when I read a passage, I had reading glasses. It wasn't like that. It wasn't like that 14 years ago. So anyway, so people have always been asking me since the earliest signings, you know, who would you like to see play John Rain if it were to happen? And Keanu's always been on my short list. So anyway, about a year and a half ago, a mutual acquaintance who's in Hollywood said, hey, I gave Keanu your books. He really likes them and he'd like to meet you. So I said, no, I'm way too busy. I said, yeah, sure. So the night before I drove down to LA, I'm sitting at the kitchen table with my wife and daughter, and I'm like, well, how do I do this? I don't really, you know, I never really met a movie star before. And I try to imagine these things, and I thought, correctly as it turned out, I was right about this. I'm like, I think it might be a little weird because I've been watching this guy's movies for like 25 years. I mean, all the way back to Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. So I sort of feel like I know him. That's how it is with a celebrity, right? You feel like you know the person, but you don't. You definitely don't. And I feel like it must be kind of weird when you meet that person feeling like you know them, even though you don't. And then you don't know what to say. Like if you just meet someone at a party, then it might be like someone might say, oh, this is Mike Masnick. He runs a fantastic blog and company, TechDirt, and does all kinds of internet security issues and intellectual property issues. Oh, that sounds very interesting. How'd you get into that? But it's just different when you feel like you already know this person, right? So I was trying to get ready for that just to think about it. Be like, so anyway, my daughter Emma says, she says, well, Daddy, I don't think you should bring up Bill and Ted. And I said, why is that, baby? She says, well, because, you know, she loves that movie. It's just a great movie. It's really held up, too, by the way. But she says, you know, it really put Keanu on the map, but he plays kind of a dumb guy in it, good heart, but, you know, not the best head. And maybe he doesn't like being associated with it that much because he played kind of this airhead character. And I said, that's a good point. All right, thank you. Good advice. Good advice. So then I drive down to L.A. I'm walking across the studio parking lot, park my car, walk across the parking lot. And there's Keanu Reeves outside having a cigarette. I'm like, okay, that's Keanu Reeves. This is surreal. So I walk up to him, and he sees me coming, and he goes, Mr. Eisler.
That's a very, very good Keanu Reeves impression.
Mr. Reeves. And I had just watched his movie, Man of Tai Chi, which is his first directorial effort. Good movie. I'd watched it, because again, I'm thinking, like, I want to have something to talk about. I want to say, hey, man, I saw Man of Tai Chi. So I watched it. And he says, just finished your second book. Really liked it. And I said, thank you. I just finished watching Man of Tai Chi. And I'm feeling a little nervous, you know. So I said, I just finished watching Man of Tai Chi, which in my house we call MOTSI because we like acronyms. And he's like, okay. So I said, and it was great. I really enjoyed it. And I got this sense, understandably, he thought I was blowing smoke or something. Because, you know, people just do that. I mean, I'm on the wrong end of that to a fraction of what he must be. Like people come up to you and they're like, hey man, I love your books. And they don't say anything else. And I'm like, oh, maybe you did, but it doesn't sound like you're, you know, you don't know them very well. Anyway, so he's like, he goes, well, thank you. I think it's a beautiful movie with a really beautiful theme. And to show him that I'd actually seen the movie, I said, yeah, that the modern and traditional can coexist and the lone individual can have an impact on a whole system. And he goes, yeah. Like, you're surprised, like, wow, this guy actually did see the movie. And then now, because I'm just nervous and shit, I said, you know, it occurs to me you like movies with themes in them. These days, it's the modern and traditional can coexist, and one man can affect a whole system. Back in the day, it was be excellent to each other. And then I'm like, here I could feel my daughter going, ah, you know, don't do this. But he laughed and he thought that was, he seemed to enjoy that. So anyway, I think he'd make a great John Rain. I was out in Tokyo with him and some other people who were involved in trying to set it up for 5 days about a year ago. It was really fun. My job was to show them all John Rain's Tokyo. And as I mentioned, not only do I love Tokyo, but for research purposes only, I do have a habit of going back there when I'm writing a new Rain book and seeking out the best whiskey bars and coffee places and jazz clubs so I can get the accuracy level as high as I like to. And while we were out there, I mean, that was my job. I'm like, well, this place. It was a really fun week. Is it going to come to anything? You know, let's hope. But even if it doesn't, then it's still been a fun ride.
Yeah, it's a good story, too. It's worth it just for the story. So, again, sort of a little shift, you know, you mentioned before, earlier in this conversation, that, you know, one of the things that you did was, you know, you had gone sort of the traditional publishing route, and then you switched to self-publishing, and that was kind of a big deal. Yeah. Obviously, you'd been very, very successful, and you had, you know, as has been talked about, you had opportunities to stay within kind of the big traditional publishing system, and yet you chose to effectively strike out on your own. So I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of what made you decide to do that, you know, and where it first became news was apparently you turned down a very large publishing deal that was put in front of you and said, I can do better on my own.
Yeah.
And what brought you to that decision?
So this one, I'll before I forget, for anyone who really wants to go deep on this, go to my website, barryeisler.com, and you'll see a link called, well, for writers, and then there's another called Resources for Indie Writers. And there's a ton of information there because it's a big topic. But the Reader's Digest version really is just this. It used to be that the only way to reach a mass market of readers as an author was through a legacy publisher, to find a paper distribution partner, and that was it. That was the only game in town. Generally, what we now call the Big Five, the New York Big Five, or a smaller publisher, but that was it. Digital book distribution, e-books, has changed all of that. And now, as writers, we have three broad choices. You could argue it's four, but three broad choices. You can go the legacy route. It's tried and true. It's still here. It still works. You can go self-publishing, which means you keep a lot more per unit. It's more a digital distribution, an online play, than it is a brick-and-mortar paper play. But you keep a lot more per copy. And it is absolutely empirically proven to be a viable way of making a living as a writer. There are thousands of writers who are making real money self-publishing. They didn't come out of the legacy world. They're self-publishing pure plays. So it's totally viable, and it's great. And another way of doing it is Amazon publishing. A lot of people don't know. They think of Amazon publishing as self-publishing. Amazon did establish a self-publishing platform, Kindle Direct Publishing, KDP, and that's the Amazon self-publishing thing, KDP. But Amazon also set up a more traditional publishing operation where you have to, where if they like your book and they want to publish it, then you, maybe you'll they'll make you an offer, sign a contract, they'll pay you in advance, and your per unit royalties will not be as high as if you self-published. That option to me is a kind of hybrid between the legacy route and self-publishing. And again, we could I could talk about this stuff until probably everyone would be like, checking their watches and stuff. But the biggest thing for me is this. The revolution in publishing is now being driven by choice. Writers have choices now where before we really didn't have any. And for me, that's incredibly exciting. And based on my own circumstances, four or five years ago, when there was a nice, healthy six-figure, two-book deal that had been offered to me, I just ran my numbers and I decided that I could do better if I self-published the next book, that by making four times as much per unit in digital, I would wind up making more money. It's more complicated than that. There's more to it. It wasn't just the money. I mentioned I like to be in charge. It's part of my problem with the CIA. They wouldn't put me in charge of the place. I mean, I would have been pretty good. I was 26 years old. I was pretty seasoned. You know? Nobody was listening to me. Crazy. Anyway, so I like to be in charge, and it's uncomfortable for me to delegate critical business decisions. If I do, the people who are going to be in charge of those decisions due to the delegation have to be ruthlessly squared away, which is not a phrase most people would associate with any New York publisher. So I wanted to be in charge of all the business decisions. And also with self-publishing, you get much faster time to market. That was important to me too. But there's no one-size-fits-all. There's no answer that's going to be right for everyone. You have to ask yourself a lot of different questions. And if you're curious about this sort of stuff and you're trying to decide for yourself what publishing route makes the most sense for me, go to my website. There's really a lot of good information there. It goes pretty broad and deep and could be more helpful than just this quick overview, I think, could be.
Now, related to that, I know that you've also been very opinionated about Amazon. Uh-huh. Now, obviously, they're in some way acting as your publisher now. But there's been a lot of debate about, is Amazon good for authors or bad for authors?
Right.
And so I wanted to get your take on it.
I'm laughing because just last week, I've never heard of these guys before. There's some institute in New York called the Winter Institute, I think. I don't know what it is. And in connection with something that used to be called the New America Foundation, now just called New America, they put on a conference, and the title was The Amazon Monopoly, a Threat? It's so awesome. It's like J. Jonah Jameson from Spider-Man. Spider-Man, menace or threat? I'm like, I don't know. It's almost like the monopoly. Is the monopoly a threat? This is, if you look up begging the question, this is the example that should be in it. So I got a kick out of it, and their panelists were just the most incestuous group of Amazon derangement syndrome people you can possibly imagine. Not only did they have Douglas Preston, he's not able to think about these things clearly, which is what happens when we get in the grip of powerful emotions. That's why powerful emotions can be dangerous. They tend to occlude reason. And that's where Doug Preston is on Amazon and publishing. But it wasn't enough that they brought Doug Preston in here. They actually had to bring his agent too. So I was laughing about that. I'm like, why don't you just clone the guy? Why don't you clone him and then you could have an extra panelist. Okay, here's my quick and dirty take. In case you haven't been able to guess from some of my remarks about surveillance and the government and the establishment media, I don't like and I don't trust establishments. And the New York publishing establishment is about as self-serving, incestuous, insular as you can imagine. I could go on and on about this, and occasionally I have, even at places like Digital Book World, where I don't think they realized quite who they were inviting to speak. Publishing is run like a cartel, not because they're bad people, they're not evil, or at least they're no more evil than anybody else, It's because they're human and subject to all the usual human inducements, incentives, disincentives. There has always been so much product, so many stories, so many books chasing such limited bookshelf space that it's just a massive seller's market. There was never any incentive to there was never any competition. There was never any incentive to innovate, to serve authors better, to compete for author services. And this all works for the establishment itself, for the club. That's not my word, by the way. They call themselves a club, as revealed in the government's subpoenaed documents in which the government proved this price-fixing conspiracy on behalf of the New York Big Five and Apple. They think of themselves as a club. That's a nice way of saying cartel. I don't mind. I'll give them the kinder word. They're a club. And Amazon's entry into publishing, the advent of digital books, the advent of self-publishing and digital book distribution has shaken up that cozy, incestuous, moribund club like nothing ever has. Of course the people in that club don't like it. I don't blame them a bit. They're like a bunch of boxers who are in a club and they've all decided that they're not going to hit that hard. And they're going to outlaw some things like, you know, it's like that left hook, man, you know, back in the day when people could throw that left hook, that really tagged me. You know, my jaw hurt for days. Let's not do that anymore. You're right. Why do we need to? And you can win this match and I'll win the next match. And so you get a kind of kabuki competition. You see two guys get into the ring, but it's all very mapped out and agreed upon how they're going to fight. And then Amazon is a new market entrant. As I see it, they looked at the rule book and they're like, they're not doing all this. They could do all these different things to train. Why aren't they using uppercuts? The uppercut looks nasty. All right. So Amazon trains and then they get in the ring and they're like, boom! And the establishment publisher's like, why did you do that? And Amazon's like, you could do it to me too. Come on. You know, it says in the rule book. And that's what's going on. That's the dynamic. And people like Doug Preston can't get it. It's just the way of the world. Publishing was run like a monopoly. It's a quasi-monopoly for a very long time. What happens in monopolies is they get lazy and complacent and out of shape. It's what happens. Why wouldn't they? I would too. How do we know? We're just lazy as humans. How do we know this? Have you ever sat down to watch a television show and then you realize and you're like, oh, damn it, I left the remote by the TV. You're like, honey? You're like, honey, honey? You know, and it's like there, you know? But you're too lazy to get up. You just don't want to do it. That's how lazy our species is. But what happens if the house is on fire? You're like, you know, beeline to the door. No problem. Suddenly not lazy. Competition is like that. So if there's an industry that's completely protected from competition, then the culture of that industry will get to the point where it's like, honey, could you? And yeah, when you feel like, wow, somebody's lit a fire under my chair, this is big, this is different, it's very uncomfortable. You don't want to admit that you become lazy and complacent and that you haven't been serving your customers or your supplier authors, your readers or authors. You don't want to admit all those things. You want to say, Amazon is evil. You know, it interests me. We live in a sophisticated culture, so-called. And people like Doug Preston, hey Doug, and Scott Turow, and some others, Richard Russo, James Patterson, who've been leading this crazy anti-Amazon charge. They know in their bones that Amazon is bad. Amazon's a bad thing. They know that. They feel it. I just came across this expression. It's like, you know, that truth you know in your heart, that's not truth. It's something else. Anyway, they know it's bad. And they don't know what to call it, but they know it's bad. And it's business. And what's bad in business? A monopoly is bad, right? A monopoly is a bad thing. So they go, Amazon's a monopoly. That's because we live in a sophisticated culture. If we lived in a more primitive culture, they would reach for words like demons or witchcraft. They'd be calling Amazon things like that because witches are bad and demons are bad. But in our sophisticated culture and in a business environment, they use words like monopoly, not really knowing what they mean, but knowing that they're bad things. Sorry to go on and on about it, but I don't like establishments, and I'm no fan of the publishing establishment in particular. And I welcome a new market entrant, including other new market entrants, Apple and Google, who are shaking up this moribund system in ways that I think will ultimately better serve readers and authors.
So tying some of all of that together, actually, you know, one of the things that's come up within the surveillance debate even is, you know, the fact that so much of you know, what came out was really enabled by these technology companies, yeah, and platforms and Google and Yahoo and Facebook and all of these guys having so much information.
Right.
And Amazon too, I
for
mean,
sure.
with their web services. I mean, they host a huge percentage of the internet. How much does that aspect worry you?
A lot.
In terms of, you know, what is the role of the technology companies within the surveillance?
I should probably talk about it more because I tend to focus on the government, but the truth is, corporate surveillance, the amount of data that's available to giant international conglomerates is also breathtaking. And the most disturbing thing, obviously, is this kind of oligarchical nexus sharing of information and capabilities in so-called private industry and the government, and really working too closely together. What's the solution to that? I don't know. There are probably a lot, but one thing is just public awareness. Because to the extent that Tim Cook is now taking a hard line against the government's insistence on backdoors and other building in the government capability to break surveillance, that's being driven by his customer base. He recognizes that. I mean, these are companies, right? They're in it for a profit. If we as consumers demand better encryption, and these companies recognize that they can't just have these cozy, incestuous, secret relationships with the government to make money, they also have to make consumers happy, there's a better chance that they'll start building into their products better end-to-end encryption that will actually protect our privacy.
Cool. So here's a quick one that somebody wanted to know, which was asking effectively how much you've plotted out your life in advance, and saying, did you happen to join the CIA to serve in that role with the idea of kind of, you know, turning your life into a John Grisham kind of thing where you would then take that information and become this massively successful novelist?
Isn't it pretty to think so? I'd love to take credit for that kind of foresight. I didn't really figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up until I was about 40. So I bounced around a lot, and in retrospect, it can seem like it was fairly carefully planned because so many of the experiences I've had wind up going into my books. But I think there's a name for this logical fallacy. It's called like the reverse bullseye logical fallacy or something. It's like if I shoot an arrow at the wall and then I go out and draw a bullseye around it, and that's kind of what's going on here. I mean, just naturally, my experiences inform my novels, right? So it seems like you slick bastard. It's like setting that novel in New Jersey. Did you pick New Jersey? Well, no, my parents, you know, they had me there. So it can really seem like that. I'd like to take credit for that kind of foresight. The truth is I feel really, really fortunate because until I started writing full time, until I got published and started doing what I do now, I always felt a little bit like I was living someone else's life, and not in a super objectionable way. I mean, my life was pretty good, I think, by, I don't know, historical standards. I was a pretty good lawyer. I enjoyed various aspects of it, but I never felt like it was really me. And I used to sort of joke with my wife, and I'd say, I feel like a traveler, philosopher, writer trapped in a lawyer's body. And I did kind of feel that way. So I feel very fortunate that I wound up, that I was stuck with the writing and I wound up getting published and was able to use all these experiences I'd had and places I'd been. But yeah, it really wasn't planned.
Well, that's a less exciting story than I know, to have plotted it all out.
It wasn't quite as diabolical.
Well, that's disappointing, unfortunately. But we've reached the point in our program where we have time for one last question, and I'll go to the audience once again because they submitted lots of wonderful questions. So thank you very much. And it says here that I also read the New York Times, the Atlantic, the New Republic, etc. What else should I be reading to get the truth or at least different perspectives? And I think that's
Tech Dirt.
I did not write this question, but I'll take the perfect setup.
This is really not a quid pro quo. Seriously, Tech Dirt is awesome, and Mike's columns in particular are, I'm sorry, but it's just true. I'm going to talk about you as though you're not here. They're so smart. They're so well-informed. They're so insightful, and they're so well-written. Really, really a great spot. So Tech Dirt, for any of these issues we've been talking about, surveillance and privacy, these sorts of things, and some others, but in particular surveillance, privacy, great, great website. And then, God, off the top of my head, I'm a big fan of The Intercept. I've been reading Glenn Greenwald religiously now since I discovered him, he was with Unclaimed Territory before even Salon. So it's been a while. I think Glenn is terrific. And he, Jeremy, and Laura have put together a fantastic team of really smart, interesting people covering topics that I think are critically important for America and the world over at TheIntercept.com. So that would be another one. The Intercept actually figures in the new book. One of the characters is a reporter for The Intercept. So that would be another one. And now I feel like I'm going to... And Shadowproof is great. What else do I get a lot of my news from Twitter, from following people rather than so much like institutions that I like, and then those people will either link to something they wrote or something that they think is interesting and worthwhile, and I'll follow it that way. And what happens is, I hadn't thought about this before, but it's interesting. It's almost like when I was a kid and you buy an album, then you could see everything in front of you and you'd rapidly get to know the names of the songs and everything. But with MP3, I don't know, it doesn't seem to work that way. I know the music, but I never really know what song is playing. And it's kind of like that with the way I get my news. But yeah, off the top of my head, Shadowproof, The Intercept, Tech Dirt, Marcy Wheeler's fantastic, emptywheel.com. I mean, she's awesome, yeah.
Yeah, incredible.
I feel like I'm leaving a lot of people out, and if you're listening, I apologize. Because hey, you know where you can find more? The 18-page bibliography I mentioned earlier. That's got a ton of great stuff in there. A guy named Jay Rosen, media professor at NYU, really, really smart, insightful guy. And so anyway, that's a lot you can find in the back of my book, The God's Eye View.
Great. Well, we'd like to extend our thanks to Barry Eisler, once again, a former covert CIA operative, attorney and Silicon Valley startup executive, and the author of many best-selling thriller novels, including his latest, The Wonderful The God's Eye View, which if you have not purchased yet, you are mandated to make sure you do it before you leave this building. I am Mike Masnick, and now I'm supposed to grab this. Yeah. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.